From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Aaron Eckhart, the star of Thank You for Smoking, the new satirical film about a tobacco lobbyist nicknamed the Sultan of Spin. Eckhart first became known for his role as a misogynist in the film In the Company of Men. The film was written and directed by Neil LaBute, who taught the film ethics class that Eckhart took at Brigham Young University. Go figure. Also, the ethical and legal issues raised by advances in prenatal testing. We talked to journalist Elizabeth Weil about her recent story in the New York Times Magazine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Aaron Eckhart, stars in the new satirical film Thank You for Smoking, based on the novel by Christopher Buckley. Eckhart is best known for his role in Aaron Brockovich as Brockovich's boyfriend, and for the four movies that he made with screenwriter and director Neil LaBute, In the Company of Men, Your Friends and Neighbors, Nurse Betty, and Possession. In the Company of Men put Eckhart on the map. He played an office worker who was dumped by a woman and becomes angry with all women. He cooks up a scheme to get even by setting up a woman and dumping her. In this scene in a bar, he proposes his plan to a friend who was also dumped by a woman. He says, "I know we're busy, but say we find some gal.
For the sake of argument, let's say we stumble on somebody, okay? And this person's just vulnerable as hell. You know, young thing, wallflower type or whatever. We're like disfigured in some way, I don't know. But just some woman who is pretty sure that life, and I mean a full, healthy sexual life, romance, stuff like that, is just lost to her forever. Okay? Anyhow, we take a girl of that type, and we both hit her. You know, small talk, a dinner date, flowers. No pushing it, not all on her blouse the first night out, but it's like taking her out to, see an ice show, something like that. And we just do it, you know, you and me, up in the ante all the time. And suddenly she's got two men, she's calling her mom, she's wearing makeup again. And on we play, and on, and then one day, out goes a rug, and us pulling it hard, and Jill, she just comes tumbling after.
Aaron Eckhart has gone on to play several other characters who use their verbal gifts for devious or manipulative ends, perhaps none as funny as his character in his new film, Thank You for Smoking. He plays Nick Naylor, America's top tobacco lobbyist, who has been nicknamed the Sultan of Spin. In this scene, he's a guest on Joan London's TV show, along with several smoking opponents and a boy named Robin who has been battling lung cancer. One of the panelists accuses the tobacco industry of trying to kill this boy. Here's Nick's response.
How on earth would Big Tobacco profit off of the loss of this young man? Now, I hate to think in such callous terms, but if anything, we'd be losing a customer. It's not only our hope, it's in our best interest to keep Robin alive and smoking.
That's ludicrous.
Let me tell you something, Joan, and please, let me share something with the fine, concerned people in the audience today. The Ron Goodies of this world want the Robin Willigers to die.
What?
You know why? So that their budgets will go up. This is nothing less than trafficking in human misery. And you, sir, ought to be ashamed of yourself.
I ought to be ashamed of myself.
As a matter
myself.
Of fact, we're about to launch a $50 million campaign aimed at persuading kids not to smoke. Because I think that we can all agree that there is nothing more important than America's children.
That's a scene from Thank You for Smoking. Aaron Eckhart, welcome to Fresh Air. The tobacco lobbyist that you play comes up with some really incredible ways of spinning the health hazards of smoking. Do you have a favorite besides the one that we just heard?
I think my ultimate favorite is in the classroom when I, on a parent-teacher, where the fathers come in to tell the kids what they do for a living. There's firemen, kids bring in their dads who are doctors, and I come in as a tobacco lobbyist and tell the class that basically to keep an open mind about cigarettes. I really enjoy that scene because it really shows my character and everything he does and how much fun he has selling cigarettes.
Do you smoke and Thank You for Smoking?
Nobody does.
You're supposed to be a smoker in it, but
yes.
I don't think we see you smoking.
No. I think John Wayne, there's a clip of him in the film, and he almost gets a cigarette to his lips, and then he's shot dead. That was another thing that Jason was conscious of. He, A, didn't want to be a proponent of cigarettes or an advocate, and he wanted people to come away from the movie thinking, well, although this takes place in the milieu of Washington, D.C. and around tobacco, it's not a film about tobacco. It's a film about a man who loves to talk.
You've made four films that were written and directed by Neil LaBute, In the Company of Men, Your Friends and Neighbors, Nurse Betty, and Possession. Now, the first two films I mentioned are two of the most like misogynistic films, and I should say, misanthropic films. It's not just women who are these characters hate. You know, the most misanthropic films I've seen. So is there anything in the characters that you recognize? Let's start with In the Company of Men. I mean, this is a guy, your character. He and his friend have been basically jilted by girlfriends. So in retribution, his plan is to find a young woman who is very vulnerable and who probably wants but hasn't really had romance in her life, who maybe has some kind of disfigurement that makes her really insecure and more vulnerable, and pretend, he wants both of the guys, he and his friend, to pretend that they love her. Just, and then dump her, just to play with her and see what happens. How did you feel about playing a character like that?
Well, can I be, I'll be a little bit multi-personality here.
Okay.
As an actor in New York with no film work, trying to get a job, and I'm not, this is not me being a victim, or this is not me saying I had to do it because I wanted to do it. As an actor, given those words, I couldn't have had a bigger blessing. I mean, to just say the words on film and to rehearse those words, it was a dream. Now, the film's plot is a little bit more hard to swallow. I went to school with Neil, at college with Neil, and I had done several of his plays, so it was not shocking when I read this. I, in fact, did the play In the Company of Men in college, in which I played the Howard part. So in the movie, I played Chad. In the play, I played Howard.
So in the movie, you played the guy who initiates the scheme.
Exactly.
In the play, you played the guy who's his kind of friend who goes along with it and gets
right. His coworker.
And he gets what's the right word to use? The nice polite word to use here. But he gets
suckered.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I
know what you were going to say.
Right.
So it wasn't new to me. I was out of work. I was happy to do it. Nobody thought that this film was going to see the light of day. We made it for $25,000. It just didn't have a chance. I had a lot of fun making it. And Matt Malloy, who played Howard in the film, and I just would, for days and days and days, just sit there and say the words to each other, which was a blast for an actor. I mean, it's so beautiful because Neil writes so beautifully. He really has a pentameter. He every word is chosen. I mean, he really agonizes over his words. And for an actor, again, that's great because they mean something. They're not arbitrary. When words and scripts start getting arbitrary, then you lose respect for the material that you're doing. Well, that's why Neil's so special. The subject matter, you know, you just have to decide whether or not you're willing to do it. And because it is drama, because drama is about conflict and tension, and we felt like it was worthwhile, I feel pretty good about it.
You met the playwright Neil LaBute when you were both attending Brigham Young University. Actually, I think he was teaching there.
He was a PhD student, so he had teaching responsibilities, and I was getting my undergrad.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny, I think, that one of the most misanthropic plays in recent memory was created at a university that's predominantly Mormon. It strikes me as paradoxical.
Well, yeah, again, it's those little ironies. and I'm sure BYU's got to be 97% Mormon. I mean,
it's
Neil and I,
Brigham Young University, yeah.
Yeah. You know, Neil and I grew up, I think he converted or his parents did, and my parents converted, so I grew up Mormon. And it's one of those things. When we would do plays there, you know, they would lock the theater. So they would take away the light board, and we'd be scheduled to have a run, you know, at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock for a week. And Neil would call me up literally after rehearsing for 3 months and be like, we can't do it. We have to do it at 8 o'clock in the morning and tell all your friends. So we would kind of do this commando one-time theater performance, which was fun. I don't know why. It's not that we have a venomous hatred for the school or anything. I had a great time there, and I really, you know, hold my upbringing. I mean, I cherish it, you know. I have nothing bad to say. It's just that I think Neil and I somehow have a little bit of a more a darker outlook or a little bit more twisted psychology.
So they tried to lock you out of the theater so you couldn't perform or rehearse?
Yeah. I think that the faculty got wind of it. See, the thing about Brigham Young was that and Neil was getting his theater PhD, and I was getting a film and theater undergrad degree, BFA. They didn't like what Neil was writing, but they couldn't deny that it was great, you know? And so they kind of had, they were ambivalent about it because, you know, when you're I don't like to use the word artist, but if you're a creative person and you cherish words and literature and plays and stuff like that, and then you read something that maybe, you know, isn't quite your cup of tea, but you have to recognize that it's really, really good and the guy that wrote it is really, really talented, you might want to foster that talent. So some of the faculty, they were divided because, you know, and at one point they say, well, we can't put this up as a representation of, you know, who we are as a theater major. But on the other hand, this guy's talented and we really want to show his work. So they would talk to Neil about it and ask him maybe to write other things. But he didn't really have any interest in that. And I, you know, didn't do Harvey, so I did Neil's work. You know, I think our play was going on at the same time as Harvey.
About the giant rabbit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess you chose the one that was more temperamental, yeah, temperamentally suited to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I read you took a film ethics class from Neil LaBute. What are film ethics?
Well, and that's probably what UCLA probably doesn't have that. You know, because of the subject matter, because of, you know, films are often rated R, and some of the best films are rated R, especially when you're going to film school and you can't see The Godfather or they won't show it.
They wouldn't show it on campus?
No, not in film school, you know. But you'd mostly concentrate it on the older films or whatever. I mean,
no, would they not show it at Brigham Young because of language and violence or?
Yeah, I think so. Subject right. matter, or if it had something had nudity. I mean, I think they cut films. Mm-hmm. You know, and a film has to agree to be cut to go there to show on campus. Mm-hmm.
So you were talking about film ethics class.
Oh, film ethics. That's right. Yeah. Neil taught that, and I'm sure it's the only class of its kind around, but Neil created quite a stir because he would read his material in class. Oh, my gosh. And literally, people would just be like, their mouths would be open. I can just see it right now. And Neil would just not give anything to him. And it was like he was manipulating us. He's playing a game with us. He would just put it out there. People would go crazy. I would just sort of sit back and laugh because I knew what was going on. But, you know, people get really upset. I mean, think about it. It's not so different than saying, is it morally right or wrong to show cigarette smoking in movies? Brigham Young, or our film ethics, basically was saying, is it wrong to, do we have a responsibility to be optimistic or hopeful or to show, you know, certain characteristics in film? It's basically the same thing because on movie sets today, you're saying, well, look, we have a responsibility not to show smoking because kids are going to think it's cool and they're going to start smoking. So it's, again, it's pretty prevalent out there, this whole kind of ethics in film. It's just that this was a class.
My guest is Aaron Eckhart. He stars in the new satirical film, Thank You for Smoking. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Aaron Eckhart. He stars in the new satirical film Thank You for Smoking, and he's been in four films by Neil LaBute, In the Company of Men, Your Friends and Neighbors, Nurse Betty, and Possession. When we left off, we were talking about studying with and working with LaBute at Brigham Young University. Are you still a Mormon?
I always, you know, it's once is, always is. I have my relationship with it and do my things. I haven't, let's put it this way, Neil and I haven't been asked back to the school to speak. I think, you know, except for, I think Napoleon Dynamite, I think that we're probably the most well-known filmmakers that have come out of school, BYU, and yet we have not been asked back.
You didn't grow up in Salt Lake, right?
No, I grew up in Northern California, and then I moved abroad.
So you grew up in communities where Mormons were not the majority population, as are at Brigham Young. So that must have been a big change for you, and probably also made you think about the whole faith differently?
Well, I certainly had a different relationship with it than people who grew up in Salt Lake. I mean, to me, it just didn't, it was different because none of my friends were Mormon. The whole community didn't revolve around that. Just didn't, I had no concept of that. When I moved to Salt Lake, it's definitely to go to school. But I did my high school in England. And if you're talking about shrinking communities of Mormons, there's not a whole lot. There are some there. And then I traveled to Australia. I lived there but they're good people, and they have really, very strong communities and family values, which I do cherish and have helped me out greatly as I grow older.
Mm-hmm. In your movies, you are always playing, or almost always, playing really attractive men. And I'm wondering what your self-image was physically when you were growing up.
I was pretty athletic. In fact, very. I love sports. I always felt like I was, you know, I never had issues of not being accepted. I was very shy when I was growing up. And so if I had any, if I had any problems, it would be through shyness. It's like I would go over people's houses and I couldn't speak, you know. I really couldn't even ask for a drink. Just very, very shy. You know, I thought I was a reasonably cool kid, you know. My mother's mother is a poet, and she was a school teacher and a writer. My mother is a writer and a poet. And I feel like I got it from them. Drama just seemed like a natural progression for me. So it wasn't like I was Owen Meany, you know, from John Irving's novels. I wasn't kind of this kid locked up in the house. I was out there doing stuff. I had a very full life. I had, you know, my little girlfriends, and I had my little rock bands, and, you know, doing all that sort of stuff. I think when I moved to England when I was 13, that really for me started, because it was very scary for me to move to England with my family. I came home from camp one day, and my dad called a family meeting, and he said, "We're moving to England." And, you know, I was just going into junior high. I was just getting into girls and all this and surfing, and it just blew us away. It just, my middle brother and I moved to England for 4 years. And I think it was there that I kind of got really introverted I kind of got in touch with my creative side and my imagination, because I really had to fend for myself for a long time. And that's when I got interested in drama.
When you said that you went through a period where you were too shy to ask for a drink if you were in somebody's home, like how difficult was it for you to speak? How untalkative were you?
Well, for example, you know, we would visit my aunt. And my aunt, at the time, this is how old I am, but my aunt loved Tab. So she had a refrigerator full of Tab, and I just couldn't ask for one. I'd have to whisper in my mom's ear. I'd say, "Can I have another Tab? Or can I go to the bathroom?" I mean, this is my aunt's house. And, you know, I look back on it now, I just go, you know, I make a point of it if I'm in somebody's house just to go open up the refrigerator, just because I just don't want that to happen to me again, you know. I make myself at home. But I didn't like it as a kid. It was very difficult because I was very, I could never really relax and settle down. And I always felt like I was imposing on whoever's house I was at. And I didn't like that at all.
Do you have children?
None. Oh. I just had a birthday yesterday, too.
How old?
38. 38, so I got to get kicking.
you want to have children?
Have kids.
Got to hurry up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not going to actually bear them, but.
I knew that.
So, yeah. No, but I feel like, you know, I don't want to be too old before I have children.
Right. The only reason why I asked is I was wondering, you know, having gone to college and not being able to see certain movies and then having made exactly the kind of movie you wouldn't be able to see, what kind of rules you were going to set for your own children about what they could see and not.
That's an interesting question. I think about that a lot. I think that I will be more lenient, I will say. I think that I will instill values, but I think that... I'll give a little bit more background as why I believe in these values and allow for a little bit more experimentation. I'll certainly be more involved with the experience of whatever my child's going through.
Well, Aaron Eckhart, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Aaron Eckhart is starring in the new film, Thank You for Smoking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Like a cigarette, I never knew the thrill of life until I touched your lips. Then, just like a cigarette.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/freshair. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And from the Dial Press, publisher of Intuition, a novel by Allegra Goodman, author of Catterskill Falls. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, is there such a thing as a wrongful birth? We talk to Elizabeth Weil. Her recent article in the New York Times Magazine profiles a mother who gave birth to a severely handicapped child. She later sued her doctor for not detecting the problem early enough to give her the option of aborting the pregnancy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In an article titled, A Wrongful Birth? Elizabeth Weil says recent lawsuits shed an uncomfortable light on contemporary expectations about childbearing and how much control we believe we should have over the babies we give birth to. Her article was published in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. This is a story that has a personal connection for Weil. The article focuses on a lawsuit. Would you describe the lawsuit that you've written about?
Yes. It was technically a medical malpractice lawsuit. In other states, it might have been called a wrongful birth lawsuit. And it was brought by Anthony and Donna Branca following the birth of their son, AJ. And AJ was born severely disabled, and they did not know this was to be the case prior to his birth. And they felt that the prenatal care that they had received was substandard, and so they sued their doctors.
What are some of the signs they think the obstetrician should have noticed and didn't?
Well, there were several things that were unusual about Donna's pregnancy. She had some bleeding during her first trimester, which was not alarming, but can be an indication of chromosomal defects. And at her midterm sonogram, at about halfway through her pregnancy, when she went in to have her fetus measured and checked for all kinds of things, the fetus appeared smaller than the doctors expected it would have based on when they originally thought she had conceived. And this should also have raised some concerns for further testing. And Donna also never gained much weight. And while none of these things alone would have been a crisis, put together, they really should have brought some more testing.
At what point did she find out that her baby had serious problems?
It was shortly before she gave birth. When she was 31 weeks pregnant while she was on vacation with her family, she started having severe bleeding and went to an emergency room. And it was at this point that a doctor finally measured her belly, measured what's called her fundal height. Basically, they just take a tape measure across your swollen tummy to get a rough estimate of how big the fetus is in there. And when the doctor did that, his estimation was this looked like a 24-week-old fetus instead of a 31-week-old fetus, which was rather alarming. And he had major concerns and, in fact, asked Donna if she'd had any prenatal care at all. And this led to a whole series of tests, including a sonogram to confirm that the fetus was abnormally small, and then an amniocentesis, which showed that the baby had both a gene duplication and a gene deletion on the fourth chromosome.
So by the time she found out that her baby was likely to have profound problems, it was too late to have an abortion if she had decided to have one.
Yes. A woman can choose to terminate a pregnancy for whatever reasons up until 24 weeks pregnant, up until she begins her third trimester. So Donna was 31 weeks pregnant, and that was no longer an option.
So what condition was the baby in when he was born?
The baby was born quite small. He weighed 2.5 pounds and was 15 inches long. He didn't cry when he came out, which is always a bad sign. And he had a whole host of problems. He had real difficulty eating. He had seizure disorders. He had difficulty regulating his body temperature. And this, of course, sent the Broncas through endless tests and 17 weeks in the hospital. And the baby was eventually diagnosed with Wolff-Hirschhorn syndrome, which is a very rare condition. But the features of it include seizures and heart problems and a shorter-than-expected lifespan. And most of the children who have it never learn to speak. Some do eventually learn to walk.
Tell us something about what AJ's life is like now and what condition he's in.
Sure. AJ now lives at the Center for Discovery in New York State. He's 6 years old. He's about the size of a three-year-old. He has 2 3-year-old siblings who are twins. And he has the mental capacity of a 6-month-old. He has a favorite toy. It's a leapfrog infant piano that he plays with all day long. And he spends a lot of time in his wheelchair, although he has very extensive physical therapy. And last summer, he learned how to belly crawl, which was a major achievement for him. And he seems placid. He doesn't seem frustrated as some handicapped children do. But, you know, he has very serious defects.
What are the Broncas asking for in their lawsuit?
The Broncas were asking for compensation for the expense of raising their child. Some states allow parents to sue for emotional damages for having a handicapped child that they did not expect to have. New York is not one of those states, and that is where they live. So they sued for money for AJ's care. And they also told me privately, and this wasn't the legally stated reason why they sued, but they both said to me that they thought they might not have brought the suit at all if Donna's doctors had just apologized to them and said, "I'm sorry this happened to you."
You know, at the same time that the Broncas are suing the obstetrician, you say they love AJ deeply.
Yes, and that's part of what's so interesting to me about this issue and about this case. The Broncas clearly love their son. Their love for him is palpable, and it's daily. You know, that AJ's father, Anthony, spent years sleeping in the same room with AJ when he was home, waking up countless times every night to feed him. In fact, he told me a funny story that he was doing everything by the book. You know, if he was supposed to get his medications, one at 2 and one at 3 and one at 4, he would wake up every hour to give them to him. And then when a nurse started coming at night, he realized that the nurse would just sort of cheat and lump them all together. But he had a parent's diligence and also fear, and so was doing everything strictly by the book. So their love for him is not something that they question, although they do really feel that they received substandard prenatal care and that they should have been given the choice about whether to go forward with this pregnancy or not. And because of the care they received, they were deprived of that choice.
So what did they win in the lawsuit?
They won a large settlement that is put away in a trust for AJ, and it's really improved their quality of life. So now, for instance, when AJ comes home, a nurse comes with him. They're also, you know, planning to take a family trip to Disneyland and that will mean bringing a nurse along also, so that they can all have time to enjoy themselves. They have two other young children who need their care also. And I think it means both that they can move forward in some sense, and not just financially, that there was some recompense for what happened to them.
Well, I think it also gets to that if you have a child who is seriously physically and emotionally impaired, then it sure helps if you have the money to pay for care. And, you know,
absolutely.
There's just a really big difference between having to do it all yourself and having some medical help. I mean, the Broncas child is in a home, isn't he?
Yes.
So, I mean, that costs a lot of money.
Yes, it all costs a lot of money. And as they were telling me, even incredibly simple things cost a lot of money. You know, even getting a kind of chair, a tumble-form chair that AJ can sit him so he can join them at the dinner table is hundreds of dollars. You know, getting a shower chair so that he can shower at their home is incredibly expensive. That all of these things place a very large burden on families.
What are the larger issues you think this case and similar cases raise?
Raises a lot of very complicated issues for us. The major one is, should we be able to decide to terminate a specific pregnancy, and on what grounds? And by that I mean, these days a pregnant woman is offered many genetic tests and for all sorts of diseases. And many, many more genetic tests are possible and on the horizon. And which of those tests should be actionable? Should a mother be able to decide that she doesn't want to give birth to a baby who will get a disease like Huntington's later in life? Should a mother decide she doesn't want to give birth to a baby who would be blind? They raise all sorts of issues. You know, right now, the most common reason to terminate a pregnancy for, you know, after a genetic test is for Down syndrome. And there is some comfort level in the country right now with that. But there are many more questions that suits like this raise.
You write that the ethics about selective abortion are being hashed out in the courts through wrongful birth and wrongful life lawsuits. What's the difference between wrongful birth and wrongful life lawsuits?
A wrongful birth lawsuit is brought by the parents against the doctors, saying we feel that we received substandard prenatal care and we wish we had been given the information and the choice to decide to terminate this pregnancy. A wrongful life lawsuit is actually brought by the child claiming, in essence, I wish I hadn't been born. I wish that you had given my parents the information to decide not to bring me into this world. And those lawsuits are much more controversial, and they're also legal in many fewer states.
My guest is Elizabeth Weil. Her article, A Wrongful Birth, was published in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. We'll hear about her personal connection to the story after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is Elizabeth Weil. In last Sunday's New York Times Magazine, she wrote an article about a couple who sued their obstetrician for not having done adequate prenatal testing to determine their fetus was severely handicapped, thereby depriving them of the option of abortion. Now, you have a personal connection to this story that you wrote about. You had a sonogram when you were 5 months pregnant with your second child. What were you told after your five-month sonogram?
Well, when I went in for a five-month sonogram, the first thing I was told was that I needed to come back, that I have a very large HMO that is very careful with these things. And I knew when they were doing the sonogram that they were having what I thought was difficulty seeing the fetus's bowels. And so I had actually gone from the sonogram off on a work trip, and when I was in the airport on my way home, I got a message saying, "We need you to come back. We're concerned that we see some spots on the bowel. It's called an echogenic bowel, and they're bright white spots that look like there's bone." So I went back, and when I went back in for a follow-up sonogram, this time there appeared to be all sorts of small anomalies. The fetus's liver seemed too big. There seemed to be some spots on the baby's brain. The bowel still did not look right. And this of course, sent my family into a spiral of bad news.
Was there a diagnosis?
There was a diagnosis, but it took several weeks. I was eventually diagnosed with having a CMV, or cytomegalovirus infection, which in and of itself is not harmful and, in fact, incredibly common. Over half of the adults in the United States over 40 have had this virus, and most people never even know they've had it. It's like having the common cold, although some people feel tired or feel like they have mono. It's only dangerous if a woman gets it for the first time when she's pregnant. So I had gotten this virus apparently for the first time when I was pregnant and had passed the virus along to the fetus. And if the virus is passed along to the fetus, then there can be really quite dire effects. We were told that the baby I was carrying would almost certainly be deaf, almost certainly be blind, and probably have very severe mental retardation.
How did you go about deciding? You ended up having an abortion, but how did you go about deciding whether you wanted to do that or not?
It was really an awful process. And part of what was so awful was the uncertainty. What we had was not like having a genetic condition where someone can say for sure, this is what's going on with your fetus, and this is what that baby's quality of life will be like. We were just told that these things were very, very likely, though it was possible we would have a healthy baby. And that was maddening. And so my husband is also a journalist, and being who we are, we both, you know, dove into doing tons and tons of research, you know, assuming that if we researched enough, we would get to really firm ground with it. But we never did. We just kept hearing the same thing. It's very, very likely your baby will be born in this extremely impaired condition. You know, I can't say that there was one moment when it became clear that we were going to terminate the pregnancy. It was just something that I think came to feel like the right thing to both of us slowly, though very painfully.
Did you have any ethical reservations about it?
You know, I fear I'm going to sound like a terrible person, but I didn't. I had lots of fears of feeling endless sadness about the decision, but I didn't feel it was unethical.
And can you talk a little bit about why you didn't think it was unethical?
I guess I very, very much believe that these are decisions to be made by families, and that the fetus I was carrying was not yet a person with the same rights and privileges that I had or my husband had. At that point, we also had a 2-year-old daughter. And I had very big fears about what bringing that baby into the world would mean for the rest of my family.
Although you decided to have an abortion, you've continued to mourn for the baby that you lost.
Yes. before we found out that the baby had CMV, we found out that he was a boy. And interestingly, that set off, you know, there was a very brief window in which we knew the baby was a boy, but we didn't know he was sick. And it was just a few days. And in those few days, you know, a whole fantasy life of hopes for what this child would be emerged, particularly for my husband. He was just ecstatic in the sonogram room and called his father to talk about, you know, all the great rock climbing adventures they were going to have, you know, all together with this son. And that's been much, much harder to let go of than either of us imagined it would be. You know, I have a daughter who's now three and also a baby who's 10 months. And shortly after the baby was born, my older daughter started asking me where babies were before they were born. And so, you know, she said, "Mom, you know, where was I before I was born?" And I was sort of at a loss for words, but I told her she was floating around up in the sky. And then she said, "Well, Audrey's her baby sister. Was Audrey with me?" And I said, "Yeah, Audrey was with you." And, you know, she got this smile that was just sort of, the world all made sense and felt all whole and put together for her. But somehow in telling her that, I had this vision of this boy that we didn't have being with them, which was just heartbreaking to me. And so that baby is really present in our lives in these unexpected ways. And I imagine that baby will stay there for quite a long time.
After you had your abortion, how long did you wait before trying to get pregnant again? And were you afraid to get pregnant again?
Well, we had a few complications, which were unexpected after we had the abortion. But my very strong desire was to get pregnant again right away. I was deeply, deeply upset by the loss of that baby and felt that the only way to get back on my feet was to get pregnant again. And I wound up getting pregnant again about 4 months later.
And were you worried during the pregnancy that after the 5-month sonogram, they'd find what they found before?
Oh, I was terrified. And I found myself not letting myself believe in the pregnancy at all until we'd sort of, you know, gotten a clean bill of health. And I think that's a very common experience for women who've lost pregnancies for all sorts of reasons, including just having a natural miscarriage, if that you don't want to let your heart start hoping for the future you're going to have with that child until you've gotten past the point where you lost the previous pregnancy.
My guest is Elizabeth Weil. Her article, A Wrongful Birth, was published in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Elizabeth Weil. Her article, A Wrongful Birth? Was published in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. I want to get back to the wrongful birth lawsuits that have been filed. And these are suits that people file against doctors for not having informed them that the baby that the woman was carrying had serious developmental impairments. You write that you think these lawsuits may bias the system toward termination of the pregnancy. Why?
Well, you know, there's a lot of fear of litigation in general, and I spoke with quite a few people about this matter. And there's a fear that the very presence of the tests suggests that these diseases are something you do not want to have. You know, we don't test for things that we all consider to be okay. And so if there is a test for Downs, or there are a prenatal test for Downs, or there is a prenatal test for cystic fibrosis, or there is a prenatal test for Fragile X, it suggests that perhaps you don't want to have this baby. And then I think the medical establishment sort of incorporates that, and there are subtle ways, it seems, in which the system tries to shepherd parents towards not having those babies.
The Republican Senator Sam Brownback and Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy have sponsored a bill that relates to what you're talking about. It's called the Prenatally Diagnosed Conditions Awareness Act. Would you explain the intention of this bill?
Yes, the intention of the bill is to give parents more positive information about what living with a disabled child would be like. And there are actually a lot of studies out there that show that raising an impaired child is, on the whole, a lot less different from raising a so-called normal child than a lot of us imagine it will be. And so right now, often when a woman goes in for an amniocentesis to find out, you know, if there are genetic defects with her baby, she's given a very clinical picture of what Down syndrome is and how that is defective. So the intent is to give prospective parents a much more balanced and positive outlook on what it's like to raise disabled children.
You know what I was wondering, among other things, while reading your article, I know that a lot of people strenuously object to the idea of terminating a pregnancy because a sonogram or another test indicated that there would be that the baby would have impairments, serious impairments. At the same time, I think a lot of the babies who are so seriously impaired would never have survived a few years ago before the kind of medical interventions that we have now. I mean, for example, the Broncus baby, AJ, there was 17 weeks of major medical interventions to keep the baby alive. It was born at 2.5 pounds. It had difficulty eating. Seizures and heart trouble are typical problems that come with the condition this baby had. It's I think, probably very unlikely the baby would have survived in an era before abortion. You know, before abortion was medically available, it's unlikely the baby would have been able to survive.
Right. It's very complicated. Yes, these babies are born into, you know, world of NICUs, you know, neonatal intensive care units, and really sophisticated medicine to keep them alive. And you know, generations ago, of course, a lot of these children would have just passed early on in life. So we're at a moment that's very complicated, and it's comparable in many ways to end-of-life issues where people are being kept alive and others are arguing that perhaps they too should pass on.
Has doing the research for the article that we've been discussing and writing about the Branca family, has it made you think any differently than you thought before about your own decision to have an abortion?
Yes, you know, the research along the way was very painful and also very eye-opening. I spoke to a lot of people in the disability rights field who had a lot of really strong arguments to make. I should say that I didn't come to regret my decision, but the points people made were very challenging to me, and frankly, I think very therapeutic for me to really think about. One issue that came up a lot was the idea of unconditional love for a child, and when does that unconditional love begin, and should we as parents have any right to choose who we enter into those unconditional love relationships with? And I remember sitting at my desk and reading these papers and feeling like a punch to the gut, but also feeling like it was very important for me to go through this and to really, you know, see what we had done clearly and to hear the arguments against it.
If fewer handicapped children are born because more women choose to get the diagnostic test. The diagnostic tests are getting more precise, and maybe more women choose to have abortions because of the results that they get from those tests. Are there concerns about how that will affect the lives of the handicapped children who are born?
Yes, there's a lot of concern that if there are fewer handicapped children, their lives will be more difficult, that there will be fewer resources for them, society will make fewer accommodations, that their handicaps will seem more strange and foreign and more difficult to bear. There have also been some critics on both sides who wonder, what will we think of the parents who have these children? Will we be sort of looking at them sideways and wondering why they decided to bring these handicapped kids into the world?
And maybe punishing them for making the decision. It's like, well, hey, you decided to do this, so, you know, now you take care of it.
Right, that maybe it will be an even greater burden will be placed on families instead of society deciding to take on more of that burden and make the lives of these handicapped kids more comfortable.
Well, Elizabeth Weil, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Weil's article, A Wrongful Birth, was published in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Count of Monte Cristo, introduced by Luke Sant, available in stores and online. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with the new website at macfound.org. And from Walmart, working with its customers throughout the month of March to help America's Second Harvest in the fight against hunger here at home at secondharvest.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, director David Cronenberg. His film A History of Violence is now out on DVD. Cronenberg's other films include The Dead Zone, The Fly, Dead Ringers, and Crash. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.